Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the day, from this day to that, for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom?
The future is uncertain, I know this. Death is inevitable, I know this. But one thing is certain, as free men, it is our right to live unencumbered and in peace. And those times are quickly drawing to an end. And in these times, peace is certainly an illusion. And as the chains grow tighter, our ability to slip those chains increase incrementally with every passing moment. Inaction is no longer an option. It's time to raise our voices like a cacophony of thunder and lightning and tell the masters no more. And this is Nighthawk, and I say, for myself, no more. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, because the freedom is slipping away.
All right, thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome to The Whole Agenda. This is Robert Morningstar, guest host for Gordon James Johnny Noto and Janet Gordon, along with our co-hosts Andrew Curry and Johnny Webb from London. I rang three chimes. It's 3 o'clock in the morning somewhere out in the Atlantic. It's actually midnight over here. And it's about 4 o'clock in the morning in London, and Johnny Webb has been gracious enough to join us. Though it's been a long day for all of us, we're happy to be here to support Gordon and Janet on The Whole Agenda. So I'm going to turn it over now to Janet.
Well, we really appreciate having you on, and I've been wanting to get you guys, you know, whoever I could get on as a guest, so this is very nice. And I just wanted to say to make, you know, donate to the radio show, freedomslips.com. And you can make your donation there with debit or credit. The show is only run by donations. That's how it stays on the air. Make sure you do that. And we like to have mail, and that's at P.O. Box 51, Ellsworth, Maine, 04605. So thank you for that. And I know we're all going to talk about different subjects tonight, and I'm up for anything. One thing that I see is that big ship on the Suez Canal.
That's blocking
that. That seems like big news to me.
Well, Andrew is as expert as anyone at this point. He had some intuitions about its meaning, its significance, you know, blocking the Red Sea. You know, some people are saying it's a biblical event, and it certainly is. Apparently, it's costing $450 million an hour because of the backlog of all the ships that cannot pass through the canal. So, Andrew, why don't you take over and tell the public, the people who are listening, what it's about? Maybe some of them have not heard. It's not the biggest item in the news, but it is a big item in world trade.
Yeah, no doubt, Robert. And please come on in and fill in when I provide the openings. But yeah, it's a massive cargo ship. And Robert, did you not say it's as long as or longer than the Empire State Building?
Yes, I said it's longer than the Empire State Building is tall, not counting the substructure of the Empire State Building. From my memory, the Empire State Building is 1,250 feet tall, and this ship is 1,370 feet long.
Yeah. And I believe we tracked it as from Singapore, right? Is that where we kind of
got that? That's where it left for, Chinese products.
Yeah, and for some reason, according to reports, as you stated, the wind pushed it sideways and crammed it or rammed it up into the concrete embattlements at the side of, where the sidewalk is, the concrete sidewalk beside the Suez Canal. Now, you as well as I are very confused how wind could do that. And
yes,
there are some very strange things about this ship. It's called the Evergreen. And at least that's the name that's painted on the side of this ship. It looks like a massive barge almost, Robert.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's Ever Given is the actual name of the ship.
That's
Evergreen,
right.
is a line. And Andrew and I have discussed this, that this term Evergreen is a code name, has been for a long time a code word for CIA operations. There was Evergreen Airlines that was flying into and out of Vietnam, also transporting troops into the Gulf Wars and out. And Evergreen turns out to have been, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't that the Secret Service code word for Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, her Secret Service detail that I guess takes care of her is called Evergreen. And the call name for the ship, now I might be getting this not quite right, but it does begin with an H, and I believe there's a 3.
Yes, and H3RC.
Go, say it again, Robert.
H3RC.
Yeah, which stands for?
Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Yeah, and Robert, the really strange thing is this ship was heading towards Rotterdam. And Rotterdam is the sister city since 1985 of Baltimore, Maryland. And, you know, I've been ruminating on this Baltimore angle today a lot more. I know one of the reports that I was watching was a report called X-22, and the guy that hosted it, his name is Dave. He only gives his first name. And he was quoting someone else's tweet saying that these sister cities refer to a Q post. I don't remember the date. It might have been 2018 or it might have been a little later. Talking about Baltimore and the movie The Sum of All Fears. Which was a whole scenario about a dirty bomb potentially going off in Baltimore. Well, you know, Robert, there's some really peculiar things about Baltimore. I just want to dig a little bit on the Baltimore side. So Baltimore apparently has one of the highest crime rates as a city in the United States of America, and that gave an opportunity for law enforcement authorities to begin essentially a high-flying spy operation. I believe it began in 2019. I'm pretty sure because I remember reading about this when we were doing one of the Morningstar Report shows. And this spy equipment is basically on these high-flying single-engine planes. And the comments are, well, we're patrolling the streets, you know, for crime, et cetera, et cetera. And I just found it a very curious thing. Like, they're rolling out this high-level surveillance, right? And this was before COVID, right? This was before the whole COVID thing began. Well, this is another weird angle, and it might have nothing to do with anything. But last night, I was at the end of my long day of work, and I went upstairs and just turned the TV on. And there was a late-night movie on called Silence of the Lamb. Silence of the Lambs, I mean. That was from 1991 with Jodie Foster and Sir Anthony Hopkins. And the insane asylum that Anthony Hopkins, who was playing Hannibal Lecter, the genius Dr. Cannibal, he was a cannibal serial killer, was in Baltimore, Maryland. And I thought, wow, this Baltimore angle just keeps coming into my purview, Robert, like over and over again. And I wanted to ask you personally, before we go back to the ship, does Baltimore have very interesting, darker, esoteric nuances to it?
Well, other than having been a very, very seedy mafia city in the 40s and 50s, you know, it is a port. It's a big
right.
port, Baltimore. Yeah. And it's in Chesapeake Bay.
Yep.
And it just is interesting that Nancy Pelosi's father was involved in that underworld scene. He was an elected official of Baltimore and was disgraced and had to leave office. I actually think he did some time in prison for it. So she fled to California and married Mr. Pelosi and her whole thing is to restore the honor of the D'Alessandro family, a comment which she made when she was elected Speaker of the House. She said, "We restored the honor of the D'Alessandro family." There was a lot of honor, to restore, and I don't think she's done a very good job of doing it. But Baltimore was an underworld city, and it was a center for all kinds of smuggling. It's very close to Washington. So there's a lot of intrigues going on in Baltimore. With regard to the Evergreen, I wonder what Johnny Webb has heard over in London. He's a whole ocean closer to the Suez Canal over there, and I wonder how the English press is treating that and discussing that, Johnny. What do you say?
I don't know if Johnny's here yet, Robert.
Really? I thought he did sign on. All right. Well, anyway, it's a very mysterious accident. I find it hard to believe that a wind could drive, although they have a huge freeboard. That's the side of the ship, placing it to the wind. But the way that the ship impaled itself, it didn't just go aground. It veered radically, strongly, and it impaled the prow. The bow is the front of the ship, and the prow is generally an extension of it that's beneath the water. When you see the ship sailing, you don't see it, but it extends about 30 or 40 feet. It's shaped like a U.S. Submarine. It's kind of a bulbous, rounded submarine structure. And when I saw the photographs of the damage that it did, it actually impaled itself like a knife. Point into solid concrete, and it penetrated at least 30 feet. They had to tear up the sidewalk, let's call it that, because there's a gangway or walkway alongside which forms the bank of the canal, and it just dug itself right under that, and they had to tear, as I told Andrew when I saw the first picture, Andrew, they're not going to be able to pull that thing out. They're going to have to tear off all the concrete on top of it. And tonight I sent out some photographs, and literally 30 feet of the ship impaled itself into the sidewall of the canal. Some people think that the more likely story is that it wasn't wind, but that the pilot fell asleep, because there's hardly any way to explain it. And the ship is so long that it just, one part went into the right bank, and the rear end went into the left bank, and basically has created a dam.
Yeah.
And now hundreds upon hundreds of giant container ships and oil ships are stuck both in the Arabian Sea and in the Mediterranean with no passage until they figure out a way of releasing the ship. And there was talk that they would have to remove containers.
Uh-huh.
You know, like railroad car type of containers. They actually can lift them off the ship, put them on trucks, or put them on trains. But it takes tremendous cranes that are nowhere near that region of the canal. So I don't know how they're going to remove those things. And of course, there's a lot of speculation that when they start to remove those things, the cargo is going to reveal something very surprising. Yeah. One of the disturbing reports that we got a couple of 2 months ago was that China was threatening the United States with missile attacks if Trump won, and this was in the Baltimore area, that they had deployed containers like they have on top of this ship that had cruise missiles inside them, so that the roof would lift off and the cruise missiles could be fired, and that that was a huge reason that we were being blackmailed during that whole charade about the election, that the reason that they had to kowtow is to avoid a sneak attack from China in different regions of the United States where these containers had been hidden containing cruise missiles. We don't know how true that is, but I wouldn't put anything past the Chinese.
Well, Robert, yes. before we move on from it, I mean, the one big thing that's happening because of this whole situation, no matter how it happened, and you know me, I'm into one of the biggest things we're going to need to change this ongoing narrative that's turned, like most of the planet, into a zombie human nation, is we're going to need an intervention. And that intervention, I'm not sure where or how that's going to happen or who or what that could be, but we need something big. And isn't it interesting that something like this happened, and the one thing that it's doing is it's drawing all eyes, all attention on this moment. And if there is something nefarious aboard, because some of the other speculation, wild or not, is that this could be a ship holding containers full of people having to do with human trafficking. And that is absolutely frightening. And I know we shared some information today, a video of one of these so-called containers that when you open it up, it, at least the video that we received, there's a whole series of seats and it's some sort of air filtration system. Now, we're not quite sure. We can't vet everything we receive, but it's just very, very interesting. And you have, again, this Clinton connection, the CIA angle. I mean, again, it could be wild. It's a little bit wild, but it is drawing attention to it, Robert. And are we going to see more of this kind of thing? Are one of these moments going to just bust something open and the narrative begins to quickly fall apart within minutes as soon as media, hopefully trustworthy media, actually get the information out? Wouldn't that be amazing?
Yeah. Whenever something like this happens, actually, I'm a little suspicious because it's like a magic show that's being conducted, and the essence of stage magic is distraction.
That's
true. So while they're doing this thing, you know, and putting all the focus on this catastrophe, global economic catastrophe, there could be something else going on right now. And, of course, you know, we have the chaos at the southern border. We have an invasion of the United States. We have the Congress trying to change practically every law and rescind every right. They've already rescinded a lot of our rights, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. Now they're going after guns. And I warn people that every time a communist or a fascist party takes over a country, the first two things they do is disarm the people and institute socialized medicine. Now, why socialized medicine? Once you institute socialized medicine, you gain control of the person's life from the cradle to the grave. And the person has no recourse. We could go on and talk about what's the symptoms that we're talking about in Canada. But before I go there, Gordon did ask for something specific from me. He wanted me to recount for you a mystical experience that I had in 1990 when I visited Switzerland, one of my childhood dreams was to fly the Swiss Alps. And the reason was a 1956 science fiction movie, 56 or 57 science fiction movie that I saw and went to see twice in the theaters. It was called The Crawling Eye. And the story was about a strange cloud that appeared on a mountainside in Switzerland, and the cloud didn't move, and all of a sudden people started to disappear from the mountain. To make a long story short, it was a very creepy one-eyed tentacled alien that was taking over people psychically first and luring them up the mountain so that it could kill them and bleed them. And the only person who was safe from the crawling eye in the movie were two pilots, an aerial surveyor who was flying around in a small single-engine plane reporting the position of the cloud, and the other one was the pilot of a Canberra bomber that ultimately firebombed the creature and destroyed it. But from that time on, I always said I wanted to fly the Matterhorn. So I had a romance with a very beautiful Italian and Swiss girl at the time, so I went to visit her in Bern, Switzerland, and I took advantage of the opportunity. So I hired a mountain pilot, mountain guide, who taught me mountain flying, which is very technical stuff. It's not easy. What you would think is common sense would get you killed over there. It's really technical stuff. So I was all psyched up for that. And the night before the flight, after I prepared my flight plan and all my gear, I went to sleep and I had a remarkable dream, which was very prophetic of what maybe 5 years later, yes, 5 years later or so, Indiana Jones and the Holy Grail. It was prophetic because I experienced in my vision what Indiana Jones experienced in the movie. And what it was is I found myself in a giant ice cave. And I entered the cave, and it was huge, and it was all ice inside. And in the distance, not too far away, but 40 feet away, there was a desk. And I walked up to the desk, and there was a wizened old angel. He was a wrinkled old man who got up, and he was an angel. And he was the angel of history. And he said to me, "Come. Let me show you what your people have done to their history." So we started walking through the cave, and as we proceeded through the cave, the cave started to narrow. It was huge and voluminous when I first entered it, but as we walked, the walls came closer, the ceiling came lower, and it was ice on both sides. And as we were walking, I remember looking to one side and seeing that there were bodies buried in the ice. And one of them was a very beautiful blonde woman whose features I couldn't see. Her facial features I couldn't see, but her voluptuous nature and her blonde hair said to me, "Hey, man, that's Marilyn Monroe." So Marilyn Monroe was there, buried in the ice. And then I kept walking and I looked to the right, and there was a tall, handsome, movie star-like man standing there in a suit, also in the ice. And I looked at him and I said, "Oh, you know, that looks like Burt Lancaster or Kirk Douglas, you know?" And obviously, getting iced is a mafia term for killing somebody, you know, packing them in ice. So that dawned on me that I was seeing bodies buried in the ice that had been killed. And I kept walking, and I have been in many caves. I went in caves in China, I've been in caves in the United States. It's a very fascinating experience. And there's a natural contour and shape to caves, and the floor of the cave. There's a natural way that the erosion and the earth movement shapes a cave. And my feet were walking, and they felt like they wanted to walk to the right. But as I walked to the right at this fork, let's call it a fork in the road, my feet wanted to go to the right, but there was a huge boulder there, and it was impossible to pass. So the angel said to me, "Come this way. Let me show you what your people have done with your history." So we went to the left in a descending path, and the cave started getting smaller and smaller and narrower and lower. And he was carrying a light, like a candle. And finally, we were crouching really low. I couldn't stand anymore. I was really crouching practically on my knees, and so was he. And then he took the light and he put it to the end of this tunnel, and he said, see what your people have done with your history. They have led you to the end of mankind. You must go back and tell your people. So we backtracked through the cave. We came to that point, the juncture, where my feet had wanted to go right, but I was forced to go left because of the blockage of the giant boulder. But this time I stood back and looked at the boulder more closely, and I realized, hey, there's something wrong with this. So I walked up to it, and I touched it, and it wasn't a boulder. It was an artificial blockage painted and made of paper mache and plaster and lumber holding up the frame, and it was an unnatural obstruction. And what I was getting to was the right track of history. We had gone down the left-hand path to the end of humanity. And he told me, you've got to go back and you've got to tell your people. You have gone. You're on the wrong track of history. So when I paused and I walked up to it, I shook it. And it was huge. It was massive. And then something fell from the ceiling. And I looked up and it was breaking apart. And there was an opening where I could see lumber and nails and broken plaster and paper mache, and I said, I could climb up there now and I could sneak through that aperture and find out what's on the other side, but that won't solve the problem. We have to remove this whole thing. So he said, yes, go back and tell your people. You have embarked on the wrong track of history and you are going, leading everyone to the end of mankind. So I agreed to do so. Backtrack. And suddenly, I found myself in a theater. In the theater, I saw the film begin. And the film was called The Film That Fooled the World. That was the title of the film. And in this theater, when I looked to the left, I saw all the people of South America. When I looked to the right, I saw all the people of Asia, all the people of India. I looked in another direction, and it was all the people of Africa, and what I was being shown was a global theater, where all of humanity was in this theater, and we were all forced to look at the screen under penalty of death, and there were riflemen in the front with automatic weapons and long rifles, and they were looking at the audience. And anyone who took his eyes off the screen was shot. I saw one man to the right take his eyes off the screen. And bing, one shot right through the head. I didn't realize then that I was watching John F. Kennedy being killed. Then I realized we're trapped in this theater. We are prisoners in this global theater, where this movie is being shown 24/7, 364.25 days a year. The film is always being shown every minute of the day around the world, keeping the people prisoner in this global theater. And I knew I couldn't stay there, because I'm not one to stay in prison of any kind. So I said, we've got to get away. So then this idea hit me. The goons, the killers, the SWAT team that was in the front, they were very robotic, mind-controlled individuals, and they had one order. If anyone takes his eyes off the screen, kill them, shoot them. So, banking on that, I got an idea, and I said to my friend, Barbara, take my hand. She took my hand. I said, Barbara, stand up. Keep looking at the screen. Don't take your eyes off the screen. We both stood up in the audience and we were looking at the screen. And the riflemen looked at us and they said, well, they're just looking at the screen. They're standing up. So we don't have to kill them. When they didn't kill us standing up and looking at the screen, I said to her, walk sideways into the aisle, but keep looking at the screen. So we sidestepped out into the aisle, and we stood in the aisle, and the rifleman looked at us again, and we were still looking at the screen so they didn't have to kill us. So then I said to her, "Walk backwards." We walked backwards, step by step, hand in hand, looking at the screen all the way till we hit the exit doors, and we pushed them back with our backs, our spines, broke out, and then ran trying to get out of the theater. So I ran to the exit, or the, well, it would be the entrance, and I hit the door, and I looked, and it was chained from the outside. The whole world was locked in a chained, sealed, global theater, being forced to watch the film that fooled the world. And I said to her, "Barbara, we've got to find a way out of this." So I saw there was a loge and a mezzanine, and I saw stairs. So I said, let's try another way. So we went up the stairs, and in one of the winds of the stairs on the second level, I saw a window. And I went to the window and threw it open, and I looked down, and there was a 50-foot drop into a raging torrential river. And I said, "Look, it's our only chance. It's our only chance. We have to take it. Let's jump." So we held hands, and we both jumped feet first, and whoosh, we penetrated into the water about 30 feet. And I still had her by my hand, and I started swimming up and swimming up. And I looked up and I saw the most beautiful blue with the sunlight streaming, and I was swimming up toward the sun. And then we broke out into the air, and I took a huge gasp of air, huge breath of air. And I woke up. And I said to myself, "Wow, man, what was that all about?" Well, it would take 2 years before I realized what that was all about. And it was a foreshadowing, a prophecy of something that would happen to me 2 years later, which was my discovery of the doctoring of the Zapruder film, the film that recorded the assassination of President Kennedy, who had had a romance with Marilyn Monroe, who had been killed because she knew too much, too many secrets that Robert and John Kennedy had told her, and then John himself killed. And everyone had thought up to that time, except I, who suspected there was something fishy about the film, everyone believed up to that time that the Zapruder film was real and factual. And within a couple of days, it was actually the day before the anniversary, so it would have been 2 years later, 1992, November 21st, CBS show called Hard Copy announced that they were going to show the real Zapruder film. And I saw a preview, and I could see the film was pristine. It was the best copy, clearest copy, most colorful copy I'd ever seen. And I just happened to have a videotape handy, a blank videotape. I threw it into the machine, and I hit record, and I recorded it. The show was half an hour long. And they went through the whole routine, and, you know, eventually Oswald did it. But I pulled out that tape and said, "Wow, I own a copy of the Zapruder film." Because, you know, nobody could have a copy of the Zapruder film at that time. You had to be very rich to be able to pay the royalties. You had to be connected and so on. But then when Oliver Stone's movie JFK came out, I went to see it. And it was cathartic. It moved me very deeply. I saw the pictures of the body in the morgue. The autopsy of the pictures, the face of John F. Kennedy. And he was one of my heroes. You know, I felt like he was an older brother to me. And I just reeled. I was shocked, you know, by the horror of the murder and the wounds I saw on the screen. And then they showed the Zapruder film as part of the trial. And then something went by as he was being shot. They had huge close-ups. And something went by that looked like lightning to me. And I went back and saw it a second time. And I thought I saw a bullet going by. So a couple of weeks later, I went to California. My brother and I had a reunion. We started talking about UFOs. So he told me about a manuscript that he had been given by a fellow security guard at this plant where he was working. He said, you have to read this. This is the real deal on UFOs. And it was a pre-publication copy of William Cooper's The Secret Government, which was the manuscript for Behold the Pale Horse. So he gave it to me. I brought it to New York, and I started reading it. And in it, William Cooper said that the Secret Service driver had shot the president and that you could see it on the Zapruder film. I said, what? Well, I've got a copy of the Zapruder film. Let me see. So I start playing it, and I start watching the driver. And at that time, I had purchased the most advanced video recorder and player around. It was a Panasonic that had slow motion and still frame and frame by frame. So I put the film in, the tape in. I hadn't seen it. I hadn't watched it since I recorded it the previous November. So I start rolling it. And I should tell you that I started making 8mm films when I was 10 years old when I bought my first Yashica 3-lens movie camera. And by the age of 15, I had been making movies for 5 years. And my father asked me for Christmas of 1963, what do you want for Christmas? And I said, I want a Bell & Howell Optronic Guy movie camera. And it was a pretty expensive thing, but there was a store named called Willoughby's, and you could do a layaway plan and pay by installments. So I got the camera, started making movies. This is important because it turns out that that was the type of camera that Zapruder used when he shot the film. So I start going through the film, and all of a sudden I start seeing splice marks going by that were not visible. When you play the film at regular speed, the splice marks went by so fast that nobody could see them. But I had seen something in 1968 when they showed the film, a part of the film on CBS News with Dan Rather commenting on it, lying, by the way, as to what he'd seen. I was tricked. I was put into a state of cognitive dissonance because at the 7 o'clock showing, I was fully concentrated on this film, and when the car went by the sign, I thought I blinked. I blinked. And I said to myself, my God, how could I blink? When I was concentrating so hard on this, how could I blink? Okay, I guess I blinked. Well, they'll show it again at 11 o'clock, and I'll watch it again then. So I watched it at 11 o'clock. And I'll, you know, if I was concentrating 100% at 7 o'clock, you might say I was concentrating 110% at 11 o'clock because I blinked. So now the car appears and rolls down the street, and when it went by the sign, I blinked again. I said, what? What? How can I blink twice at exactly the same point? And it gave me a really bad feeling in my stomach. It was my first experience, or I should say my second experience of cognitive dissonance. And it was an unwholesome feeling. And I'll tell you honestly, it made me feel ashamed of myself because I prided myself on my powers of observation, my ability to pay attention, my concentration, and all of that went out the window at that second showing. How could I blink at exactly the same moment? To make a long story short, 30 years later, I found the copy that they showed that night on CBS, and when the car passed by the sign, they had interposed a black frame, a completely black frame. And since I watched television in total darkness, I know they said it's bad for your eyes, but I always like to watch TV in total darkness with only the screen illuminated. So when the blank frame, a black frame, was presented, the whole room went dark for 1/30th of a second, and I thought I'd blinked. That was the first experience of mind control that I had suffered. And we've suffered many. We're going through several stages of it right now. So that's how I discovered that the Zapruder film is a consciously engineered mass hallucination. It is the greatest example of mind control ever achieved in the Western world until this pandemic was foisted on us. This is equal and goes beyond. It goes beyond the JFK assassination. Because in the JFK assassination, the media was fooled to believe what the government was telling us. But in this mind control operation, the media is complicit. They are co-conspirators with the United Nations, with the Communist Party of China, with the World Health Organization, with the NIH, and a cabal that has taken over our country, that rigged our election, that cheated Donald Trump out of his obvious victory. And now I'm working to tear away the mind control apparatus that's been imposed on people over this COVID vaccine situation. I'll say one more thing. The man who appeared to me to be the old wizened angel of history was none other than C.G. Jung, the father of Jungian psychology and the revealer of the existence of the collective unconscious and the archetypes. And I dedicated my life to Jungian psychology and Gestalt psychology and sacred geometry, and through those skills I was able to break the hold of mind control exercised by the fake Zapruder film. I'll tell you just three things. The car stopped twice. That's why they put in the black frame, to cover up the fact that the car stopped behind the sign, that the president had been shot while the car was behind the sign, that the president stood up in the car and would have been visible in the film popping up and dropping down, because Mr. Zapruder testified that he saw that, and that the car crawled. It crawled from the sign to the grassy knoll, where three shots crisscrossed President Kennedy's head and obliterated his mind, his brain. And Jackie Kennedy was a heroine. They made her look, this is the ultimate libel and slander of the Zapruder film, is that they tried to make us believe that Jackie Kennedy panicked and jumped out of the car trying to escape being shot. That was not true. She jumped out of the car to retrieve a piece of bone and brain that had landed on the trunk of the car. So up to 1992 and 93, everyone thought that the Zapruder film was real. Until I went to Chicago in 92 and in 93 and started to demolish it. The film had been controlled by one man who had stolen the original from the National Archives, duped it, put in a dupe, and then he was demanding $5,000 to $10,000 per appearance to show the film. He is unworthy to have his name mentioned. But he was an agent of the government. He had been a captain in the U.S. Army, and he was a member of ELINT, Electronic Intelligence, which dealt with electronic intelligence and mind control. So I broke the hold in a large group of people. I am told that today 85% of the people who see the Zapruder film don't believe it's real, and they shouldn't, because the optical illusions are all over the film. First of all, people think they see the car turn the corner. They don't. The car just pops into view. People think that the first three motorcycle men that come around the corner are the same motorcycle men that were riding with the parent, with the president and his motorcade. They weren't. But this is how the collective unconscious works. It speaks to us through dreams and visions. And I am a person who has learned to listen. And I hope that satisfies Gordon, because I don't want to take the whole show up with, you know, dismantling the Zapruder film. Just safe to say that there is a YouTube that I produced on my channel on YouTube, and it's called Warning, the Ultimate Secret of the JFK Assassination. And in that 40-minute video, I tell everything, including the last and most disturbing fact. The person that I was so moved by those photographs that were shown in the film JFK of the dead president and the ghastly look on his face and the hideous head wound. I felt so much compassion and sorrow and sadness for my hero that I felt I have to do this work. It's incumbent upon me. It's been laying on my shoulders and I would be a coward to run away from it. So 2 years later, year and a half later, after really diving into the JFK assassination and all the evidence, I realized that the person in the photographs was not President Kennedy. It was actually Officer J.D. Tippit, who had been slain about 40 minutes after the president was killed. Police Officer J.D. Tippit was assassinated on the streets of Dallas in Oak Cliff. And as he lay dying, the assassin, after putting three bullets in his torso, walked up to him, lying dying in the street. He put a gun to his head, the right temple, and he fired one shot into his head. The bullet hit the back of the head, but did not exit. It cracked the skull and sent back in. And that's the brain that they used to do the Warren Commission autopsies. They stole both bodies. They sent them both to Bethesda Naval Hospital. And they pulled the old switcheroo on these poor doctors that had been drafted to do the autopsy. Not a single one of those doctors had ever done an autopsy before. But they were commanded by the Army and the Navy to do these deeds. And it took 35 years for me to prove that the man, the victim at Bethesda in those photographs, is not President Kennedy, but his body double, J.D. Tippit. And the apparatus that was installed between 1963 and 1970, MKUltra, mind control apparatus, and Operation Mockingbird, which was the takeover of all newspapers, television stations, radio stations, magazines, editorial boards, and planted CIA agents as reporters in all of these institutions. Operation Mockingbird works hand in hand with MKUltra, and this is the worst mind control operation that has ever been exercised on mankind, including the Soviet Union and China, because this is global. Those were national. So I hope I have satisfied Gordon's request. And I'll turn it back now to Janet.
Well, I really like what you're doing. I didn't have a lot to say.
Well, we can go to Andrew. I know Andrew has a lot to say about things like this.
I've been doing this show for about 5 times. And I always find something to talk about, but I've wanted guests, and now I have guests, and I like it.
Oh, well, I'm glad to be here. I'm happy to help you out.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure. You are both very dear to me, and it was Gordon's idea long ago, saying, Robert, you should have a show on Revolution Radio.
Yeah. We love you, Robert.
Well, that's the feeling is mutual. So I would like to turn in now to Andrew then. Perhaps he has some comments or insights or something to say about all of this.
Well, you know, Robert, what's really interesting is this hypnotizing of humanity it's in everything. I mean, I'm realizing now that every institution of humanity, every institution, you name it, whether it's political, economic, religious, scientific, education, sports, I don't care. Every single institution has been infiltrated by something very unusual and very dark. I have come to that conclusion, Robert. I'll give you a really quick example of this. I am, in my community here in Vancouver in British Columbia, Canada, and I'm in specifically in North Vancouver, you know, we get involved, some of us get involved in coaching our kids or being on a board of like some sort of sports team that they're involved in as youth. And I remember serving on one of these boards, and I won't name it. I don't want to get into names. And I'm going to tell you, Janet and Robert, these are, you know, they're good people, but I couldn't get over the feeling when I went to these board meetings how there was something amongst us, or maybe in one of these people, that just had a different idea on how to run this operation. And I know I'm talking about youth sports, but what I mean by that is it was almost like this feeling that someone is in the room wanting to veer us off in a completely different direction. And I've never been able to get over that feeling in all the different youth sports things that I've been involved in. And then when I extrapolate from there and I see what happens in the politics, you could say, oh, that's just normal politics. That's just people wanting control and they're exercising it in these little, you know, Mickey Mouse scenarios. But I'm telling you, it's a feeling. And then you see the things that sort of flow from that, the sort of policies that happen, and you're like, where is the celebration of excellence? Where is the encouragement of possibility and potential in these children? I mean, maybe it's just some Canadian thing or some whole, you know, like we just suppress any kind of achievement. We don't draw attention to it. But I'm telling you both that there is something that has bled into all of our institutions and has spoiled it. And it is up to us now to reveal it, like you did, Robert, via a dream, and yes, then seeing the evidence. And every one of us needs to bring that dream time to this reality. I'm going to tell you, I had a dream last night. It's funny that you should talk about dreams, Robert. It was the strangest thing. I can't recall everything, but for some reason I was in India, and there was water, and there were snakes, but there was all of these transformations going on. I was going through this alchemical process of changing or being involved in these changes. So, again, you know, Janet, I threw that out there because Robert and I often get on air, and for some reason our intuitive probing somehow a few days later end up in the mainstream news. Robert, do you want to explain to Janet what happens to us?
Well, I think we enter mystical states, in our dream states, these lucid dreams. You know, the ones, I'm going to share another one that's a little more hopeful. It's actually a little more hopeful. And it happened to me a couple of days ago. But the collective unconscious, or God, speaks to us in the dream state. But it presents the message in symbols and locations. And you have to be able to interpret the symbols. Now, this faith that I have in the messaging of dreams goes back to the Bible. When I was a young boy, probably ages 10 to 12 or 13, you know, I read the whole Bible. And the story of Joseph and the coat of many colors made a deep impression on me. And the story is that Joseph had this ability to interpret dreams. And as a result of that, he was called into the Pharaoh to explain a dream that the Pharaoh had had. The dream was that the Pharaoh saw seven fat cows, and then suddenly something happened, and all of the cows were scrawny and showing bones and skinny and dying. And he was really disturbed by the dream, so he called Joseph and he said, you know, I've heard that you are quite skilled at interpreting dreams, so this is my dream. Tell me what it represents. So seven cows, right? Seven fat cows, seven lean cows. So Joseph said, that represents that you're going to have 7 years of plenty, but that it's going to be followed by 7 years of drought. And so it would behoove you, Pharaoh, to prepare during those 7 years of plenty for the 7 years of famine and want and hunger that is to come. So for 7 years, the Pharaoh drove his kingdom to produce and to hoard, to save. And when the drought came and the livestock were scrawny, they had enough food to survive the 7 years. I believed that story. The other story was also what got Joseph in trouble. He had had a dream that he was dressed in a coat of many colors and that these stars came around him and the stars bowed down to him, and he told his brother and his father the dream, and they didn't like it because they identified with the stars that were bowing to him. And he's saying, "We're going to bow to you." So that got him in trouble, and his brother sold him into slavery and told their father that he had died, that he'd been killed. So that story is the cornerstone of my belief in prophetic dreams and interpretation. Dreams have saved my life many times, including dreams of horrible accidents that I could not avoid being in, but that I was able to change enough so that nobody was killed.
Well, even though the same here with me. I'm a real dream time person. I dream what's going to happen the next day. The ETs yes. contact me through dreams and tell me where to meet them up for the next day. And I do that. But yeah, dreaming is the Aborigine tribe says you're more awake when you're dreaming than you are actually awake.
Yeah. You know, there's a famous story in China. There are three great philosophers of Taoism, Lao Tzu, Chuang Tzu, and Mo Tzu. Mo Tzu, most people don't talk about him, but he was the first person in history to come up with the concept of universal love. And Chuang Tzu was a very mystical fellow, and he told a remarkable dream. He said he had a dream that he was a butterfly, and the dream was so vivid that when he woke up, he was confused, and he started to wonder whether he really was a man who had dreamed that he was a butterfly, or was he a butterfly dreaming that he was a man. So speaking of dreams, I want to share a hopeful one. It was kind of disturbing, and it happened to me about 4 days ago. And in the dream, a dear friend of mine, I heard a tinkling. We have a break, right?
Yeah, we have a break.
Okay. I'll come back to the dream. This is Revolution Radio. Freedom's Lips.com. Back in about 3 or 4 minutes.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Como va? This is Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. I pulled some strings and gotten you front row seats to my new show, The Perfect Triangle. Live Friday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Revolution Radio Studio A. The perfect triangle is equilateral, three sides of the same length. In an angry, bipolar world, three perfect sides reveal many truths.
Body, mind, and spirit.
Thought, word, and deed.
Conspiracy, propaganda, and truth.
Natural health, allopathic tyranny, and your body.
Freedom, globalism, and sovereign nations.
And so much more. Each week, the Perfect Triangle will blast through fake news lies, champion the natural way and natural law, unravel the Orwellian deceptions of our corrupt government, reveal the satanic evil of globalist banks and transnational corporations. Tune in every Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, to Revolution Radio Studio A for thoughtful discussions with free thinkers. Your calls are always welcome. The Perfect Triangle with Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. Join me, won't you?
Please, come on, Lee. Hi, Karl Marx here. I am all seriousness today, my friends. There is this show you must not listen to. The ultimate remedy with this guy, LB. This guy has figured me out. I hear it on Tuesday, and he is telling the truth. I mean lies. Stay away from this guy. Where's my good hairbrush? Anybody see my mama?
Want to learn more about the Marxist agenda and other important stuff? Listen to The Ultimate Remedy with L.B. Bork, Tuesdays, 6 p.m. Eastern, right here on Revolution Radio.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
I want to thank everybody for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the one place where information never sleeps. Revolution, Revolution Radio!
All right, let's show them what we got here.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Hi, everybody. We're back. This is Janet, and we got Robert and Andrew on, and it's been a very interesting conversation. And we were talking about dreams, and Robert has a good something or some great dream that just happened recently, and he's going to tell us about it. So there you go, Robert.
Yes, thank you very much. This dream was, you know, disturbing, but at the end, very refreshing. And the dream deals with a friend of mine named David, who's been a very dear friend and an angel to me. Folks, I'm going through very difficult times just like you, and I need your support, and I'm going to ask you for your support a bit later. David has helped me survive this year, and he was in my dream. And in my dream, he lent me his car, and he asked me to pick him up at a certain location. So in the dream, I was driving this very unusual car through the streets of New York, and I was happy because I'm a really great driver in New York City. I've driven here for, I guess, 60 years. Well, not 60, 50 years. The car was white. It was a BMW, but it was a station wagon. Strange car. Has anybody ever seen a BMW station wagon? They're very rare. So anyway, that was odd. So I'm driving around, and all of a sudden I get into this place where I don't know the roads. There's not a grid. It's not right angles. Everything is winding and turning. And I'm driving around, and I'm lost, and I don't know where I am. But all of a sudden I realize, wow, this looks like Washington, D.C. And I came to the end of a road. The road extended, and then I saw no more road. It was like very high up. So I stopped the car and I said, I better take a look at what's on the other side there. So I stopped, I walked over to the edge of a precipice, and I saw what looked like a wooden boardwalk that descended down this very steep slope going down to a kind of black lake. It was not black, it was blue, shining, reflecting the sun. Later it turned black. And I just said, whoa, I'm not going to drive the car down there. I couldn't make it. And all of a sudden, I didn't put the car in gear, and the car rolls and goes down that boardwalk, because it was made of boards. And I see the car slide right into the lake. And I go, oh, my God, what am I going to tell David? His car just went into the lake. And it was so steep that I couldn't go down that way. And so I walked around circuitously, came around to the side of the lake, and there I could see the car. It wasn't very deep. I could see the car under the water, and I said, I've got to go in there, and I've got to get that car out. So I waded into the lake, and as I waded in the lake, the previously blue water and clear water was started to muck up, and it started to get black and inky and oozy. And I kept walking where I saw the car, and then I just guessed, the car is here. I stuck my hands into the lake and pulled up the car. You can do these things in dreams, folks. believe me, you can do these things in dreams. You can go in and you can, and the car will shrink and you can pick it up like a little white box. So I walked out and said, oh, I got the car. You know, I'm going to have to wash this. This is filthy. So I walk out and I got up onto the shore and I put two steps on the shore and I heard this noise. And this noise was a roar. Like that. I turned around and the lake was gone. And it wasn't a lake. It was a swamp. And the swamp had been drained. And I looked down a 100-foot hole and I could see machinery that had been turned on. And I, you know, when you pull levers and pumps in the old days, they used to have big knobs, like sometimes they were black and sometimes they were red. And I remember looking down like 50 feet through, and it was 100 feet deep, but at 50 feet, there was control mechanism and somebody had pulled this red lever, which had drained the swamp. And I came out of that realizing, wow, this is a great dream. It was not fun. It was very disturbing. When I jumped into the lake, I was wearing a white suit, white shirt, white suit jacket, white pants, and I jumped into the muck, and I got it all filthy and dirty and blackened, and I took one, two steps, and then I could have been carried away if I had stayed in there 2 seconds longer. But the message of the dream was the swamp has been drained, right? So folks, let's have faith. Something big is happening, and I feel that this dream is giving me heart, giving me courage, perseverance to keep working and not to lose faith in ourselves, in our nation, in the Constitution, in the real President of the United States, and that all of this villainy and all this scum is going to be drained away. Even as I speak, it's happening. So have faith and believe in your dreams. And there are many more that I could go into, but perhaps we should share one from Andrew or Janet. I have another one that involves ETs a little bit later on in Dr. Carl Turner, and I'll tell you about that because that is related to the COVID vaccine. But Andrew, what do you think of that one? I think I told it to you a couple of days ago. Yeah.
Well, immediately when you related it to me privately in our back channels, I immediately thought of the swamp. I mean, it's kind of a.
Yeah, I didn't realize it till about an hour after I woke up.
Oh, interesting.
To me, it was the Black Lake, but then I remembered being in it and the feeling of it and the bottom of it. And it was a swamp. The deception was that because it reflected the sky, it looked blue.
Right.
It was really polluted and black and murky. And that's why I call her Nancy Pollution. That's my nickname for the Speaker of the House, the Squawker of the House.
Well,
Nancy
Robert, there is.
You go ahead.
Yeah, there is one dream, and I related it. It's interesting we're on dreams. This is good. I mean, it's later night for a lot of folks, and yeah, Janet, and I loved your how you spoke about the Aborigine people talking about dream time. It's funny you should say that because I feel the same way. Sometimes when I dream, it seems so intense and colorful that I feel more free inside that space. And I remember as a child, well, I was going to talk about my own child, a dream that my youngest had just recently, but I'll tell you one dream I had when I was very young. So we lived in a small house. You wouldn't believe it, but the house that I grew up in was actually a little pink house. So John Cougar Mellencamp really was singing about my place. And then my grandfather renovated it, and we had it a little bigger. But my sister and I slept in the attic, in the upper part of the house, which was attic-like. It was a sloped ceiling for her at one end and in the room at the other end. And I remember one night I was dreaming I was heading downstairs, to use the washroom or whatever. And the next thing I knew, my legs lifted up. And I was floating to the, you know, to the ceiling above the stairs. And I had, and I remember the detail that I had to hang on to the railing so that I wouldn't sort of bounce along the ceiling. And I, because my body was just like kept suspending. And then I remember the next thing I was outside floating up towards one of the lamps, one of the lamp standards. And I remember as I got closer to the lamp, I could see the insects, you know, the moths and the bugs just buzzing around the light. And I remember, you know, sort of slipping in and out of that imagery. So, and I remember that dream seemed so real because it really felt like I was flying. It was a fascinating feeling. And it's funny, it's in those details, like holding on to the railing, because I'm like, whoa, if I don't hang on, I'm just going to, you know, bounce down the, you know, along the ceiling, basically. But I wanted to relate a dream that my youngest son, he's 9, and one morning he said to me, he said, Daddy, I dreamt of heaven. And when we shared this on Robert's show, and so I was listening to him, and he's telling me about heaven, and I says, yeah, there was just like all these clouds, it was sort of misty and cloudy, and he said there was the occasional tree, and there was these two sort of cliff sides kind of in the foreground with water flowing over. And then I said, well, what happened when the water hit the clouds? And he said, well, they just sort of disappeared into more clouds. And he said that he was floating above his school ground, and down on the school ground he could see his friends in the schoolyard, and they were all frozen. And Robert, what did you say about that when I mentioned to you how my son had said that the his friends in the school ground were frozen? Remember what you said?
Yeah, I said that he was probably traveling at the speed of light. Remember?
Yeah, exactly.
Because
and
if you reach the speed of light, time stops. So I thought, obviously, he had to travel a long way to get to heaven and see this vision. So he was probably traveling at the speed of light, so that's why everybody seemed like they were frozen in place. But you just said something that adds a deeper level to it. It was a detail that you may have said when the previous two times we discussed it, but you didn't say it in this way. You asked him what happened to the water when it spilled over the cliffs and at the clouds, and he said they just disappeared. Do you know what the highest waterfall on Earth is called? It's in South America.
No.
It's called Angel Falls.
Oh, my goodness.
And it the water pours in cascades, and but it falls so far that it never hits the bottom.
Oh, interesting.
It just breaks up into mist. Look up. You should show a picture of Angel Falls to your son.
Well, Robert,
anyway,
let me finish. So he was so he and he kept describing his wings. He kept saying, "Oh, my wings were so small," because he's young, right? He's 9 years old. And I said, "Well, you are 9, so if you're having that dream now, then you know maybe that's the right kind of size wings." So then I said, "Well, what else did you see in heaven in this landscape?" And he said, "Well, I saw Jesus," and I asked him, "Well, can you describe him?" He said, "Yeah." He said he had long hair that was sort of shoulder length and was black, and he was wearing pink robes. They weren't white, they weren't red. It was sort of a pink, almost rose color. And around him were gathered many, many angels, people that he recognized. And he says, "And Daddy, I saw you there too, and you had big wings. All the adults did." And I said, "What did Jesus do?" And he said, "Gather around me. I have something to tell you." And at that point, everybody gathered around. But because my son is smaller, he was sort of more on the outskirts or something. He knew that Jesus was speaking to all the angels, but he couldn't quite understand what he was saying. Now, my son had a very interesting dream during the lockdown, which he drew. I actually had him draw the one in the heaven one too, but I can't really share it on this platform. But the dream he had during the sort of pandemic lockdown that we experienced here in Vancouver, you know, a year ago or so, he saw Jesus. He thinks it was Jesus sitting cross-legged. He called it crisscross, with his back to him, so back to my son, on the ramparts of an ancient castle. So like on the, basically the broken walls of an ancient castle. And he was sitting crisscross in sort of, again, these sort of pinkish, almost brown robes, and he was staring out at either a sunrise or a sunset, and he was sitting alone. So it's very interesting that this next dream he had about a year later, now Jesus is no longer turned his back on my son in the dream, but is now engaging not only my son to a degree because he was there, but the angels, the people being brought forward. So when Robert said that, you know, we need to, oh, Robert, how did you put it? I'm going to mangle what you said, but we have to engage our creativity, our dream time, and listen to our children. They're telling us things, and our kids are very insightful. Robert's been very, very gracious and very generous the way he describes my children. And, well, Robert, I wanted you to explain about Stellan a little bit.
Well, he's a cherub. He's 8 years old, 9 years old, very intelligent, very sweet, very kind. He has a love of nature. He has an aquarium that he is very dedicated to maintaining. And he's very insightful, very sensitive. And that dream of heaven is loaded with messages for all of us. I said to you today that it seems that fate has appointed us to be angels and ministers to other people, and that's why we're happy to be here with Janet and Gordon. So he's got rosy cheeks, and he's a very centered little boy. I really enjoy conversing with him when we have occasion to, and I really enjoyed that visit to heaven. I've had several near-death experiences and death and coming back. And on July 7th of 2007, it's a very significant date, it's the seventh month, the seventh day, and the seventh year of the millennium, I had a near-death experience. I went out, and it was a very hot day, and I worked out and taught my Tai Chi classes, athletic classes, very vigorous. I've developed something called Tai Chi sports, which are applications of Tai Chi, not just the slow motion form. It's really very rapid, very fast and dynamic. And I played my heart out. So I came home and I lay down to rest, and it was a really good rest. You know, when you get so tired, you've exercised every single muscle in your body. You've poured out sweat. You've given it your all. And I lay down, and I could hear my heart going, ka-kum, 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 ka-kum. And then all of a sudden it started to slow down. I went, ba-tum, 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 ba. And my heart stopped. And I said to myself, oh my God, this could be the last heartbeat of my life. And when I said that to myself, suddenly my consciousness went into a very specific point in my head and my brain. And I found myself immersed in living water. And I was in God's presence. And God said to me, oh, I'm so happy you're here. I've been waiting for you for a long time. And if you touch your right ear and move around to the back of your head, there's a notch, there's the skull, it's really hard, and then there's this soft tissue, and it was right there, slightly to the right of center. At that spot was where my soul was. And it was living water, and it was blue azure, and the light was coming out of the water, and God said to me what I just said to you. Oh, I'm so glad you're here. I've been waiting for you for a long time. And I knew that he meant you're here, and, you know, you could stay here, but it means you're dying. You know, that could be the last heartbeat of your heart. And I said, God, it is so beautiful here. I am so happy to be here with you. And I'm not afraid of dying. But my friends wouldn't understand. My mother would be heartbroken. My girlfriend would be in grief. All of the people who love me would be in such sadness and sorrow. God, I'd love to stay with you. But please, may I go back? Not for me, but for my mother and for my friends. I don't want them to suffer this. And he said to me, of course you can. But do you have to go back right away? And I said, no. And he said, why don't you stay here for a little while? And I stayed there for about 3 hours, in between two heartbeats. Ba-dum, 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 ba. Thump, ba. And I stayed there between the pa and the thump for 3 hours. And then I came out. And I was so full of life and so full of joy and happiness that I decided to go to Central Park and contemplate this mystery. I did pass out. After I stayed there for a while, my consciousness dissolved and I went into, I guess, sleep or trance or something. And then I came out. And then I went to Central Park to the Sheep's Meadow. I played a little frisbee with some strangers that I met there. Then I walked out and it was just around sunset. And I took a long route out of Central Park. 66th Street is where Sheep's Meadow is. But if you walk north, there's an exit at 72nd Street, which is right near the Dakota, where John Lennon lived and died. And so I chose that path. And when I came out of the park, I looked down the street. And on July 7th of 2007, the sun was going right down the center of the street. And it was very low, just above the horizon. And the light hit me. And I remembered something. I remembered a message that I'd received from God and Christ. And the message was, if you really want peace on earth, then be me. I will reiterate. If you really want to have peace on earth, then be me. B-E-M-E. Meaning, become me. Incarnate me. And that is something that I have striven for, to live a life like that, to channel and live that message and to convey that message. If you want to see Christ return to earth, then you must become Christ yourself, or a worthy vessel, a repository for that energy. That's Christ is life. That's something that I have learned. When he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. A lot of people translating that to light now. It's not that. It's not what it says. It's not, I am the way, the truth, and the light. It's, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And what he means is that he is the life. Christ is the life that's going through your veins right now, keeping you alive, maintaining your heartbeat, measuring your breath, controlling your blood flow. So he's already here, but he's hiding in the background. Yeah. He's hiding in the background. You have to find him. You have to dive into yourself and find the Christ in you.
Exactly.
Is Gordon all right?
Oh, yeah, he's on the couch. He's okay. Listening.
Okay.
But I wanted to just tell you, when I was 17, I was very sick and I ended up in a hospital. And I had a cross of Jesus that I had found somewhere like on the ground, but it was beautiful, so I wore it around my neck. And I wore it for a long time because I was, you know, reaching out spiritually for a healing. And I was feeling very close to some sort of a spiritual guidance or healing, and I was in the hospital, and I went to bed that night, and all in the dream time, the whole room filled with light, and Jesus stepped into the room. It was like he became, there was a river outside the hospital, and he came right out of the river in a white light and was right in my room. And I was holding his necklace, and I remember him giving me so much love and life that it healed me. And right after that, I had that vision. I dreamt it was snowing, and it was only October in Maine, and normally doesn't snow that early. And so later, when the orderly came in, or one of the nurses, I don't know, and they said, oh, you know, it's snowing out there. And I said, I know, even though I hadn't looked out the window or anything. But I knew that that was a sign that dream was really real, because I not only dreamt that Jesus was in my room, But then I knew because it was snowing too, so these visions were real. But that was a healing, and it was very strong. And so I feel that Jesus is still walking, the masters are still walking this earth, unless we're the masters, you know, being Jesus in action. I'm not sure. But up here on this mountaintop, I've seen St. Francis, big as life, standing over by the bird feeder, thanking me for feeding the birds.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So I think the masters are already here. I mean, these people, these spiritual people, they're here on Earth.
Yeah. I think that as long as we're talking about Christ, I think we should talk about the devil, too, because I've experienced him in my life, too.
Oh, I have, too.
It. And the thing I have to say to you is that there's a great misconception, particularly among Satanists, that the devil can give you power, that the devil can confer upon you powers or riches, and it's not true. He has no power over you and can confer no power upon you that isn't your own. And there are two tricks of the devil. One is that to make you believe that he doesn't exist. And the second one is to make you believe that you should serve him. The great frustration of the devil is that in the hierarchy of the cosmos, from heaven to hell, he's down, way down on the ladder. And it's God, Christ, man, devil, demons, and so on. No. He is supposed to be a servant, and it is a power. You are not to worship the devil. You're supposed to tell him what to do. That is the fact. And anyone who thinks that they're going to get anywhere by worshiping the devil is on the wrong path to loss of soul and self-destruction, depression, suicide. He is a murderer. Mm-hmm. He is a deceiver. And this sensation that Andrew has been talking about, he feels it's something wrong. It really is the exercise of demonic forces by people in power who have given themselves up to that fallacy that their power is coming to them from their satanic worship and their evil deeds. But nothing could be farther from the truth. So remember, he's not a master. He's a servant. And he's a servant of Yahweh. It's really strange that Yahweh and Satan have a relationship described in the Bible, in the book of Job. You know, Satan the accuser, his role is to undermine humanity and to test us and to deviate us. The word devil comes from a Latin root, dis and D-E-V. So to deviate means to get off the road, get off the path. Devia, getting off the way. So there's a lot of distraction and trickery, mendacity, deception. But God has given us all reason and logic when properly exercise. Now, here's the problem. A lot of people are operating on logic, but logic only works if the material, the facts, are facts. If you're weighing truths, you will always come to the right conclusion. But if you're being misled, disinformed, deceived, lied to, and you take an element of falsehood to be true, you will always wind up with the wrong conclusion. You will never get to the right place. So that's something to think about. The devil is supposed to serve man. He's not to be the master of man. Yes, Andrew.
That's exactly what we're seeing with mass media and big tech, government, and this medical tyranny, is we are seeing misinformation. I mean, I have come across so many anecdotal stories in the last couple of days of people saying, you know, health officials saying, oh, no, don't ask any questions. Just take the jab. Don't look anything up. Just take it. It's good for you. The rewards outweigh the risks. Robert, you sent an email about this. It is such deviance beyond belief. And there is this very, very strange cult-like adherence now. If you don't wear a mask, people look at you horrified. They're ready to tear you from limb to limb. It's not everybody, but these gatekeepers. And it's almost like they've been, Robert, we've discussed this many times, Janet, and that's that there's almost a possession-like quality in people now. It's really strange. It's like the frontal cortex has been switched off and they've become an open sieve for garbage and for, I don't even want to call it soil or dirt, because soil and dirt, I work with it in my garden. I love it. I'm talking about garbage coming through, and it is become a repository for insane, illogical, non-factual edicts that are being put out there against. Let me give you an example. My wife's mother-in-law, because her father remarried. Now my wife is originally from the Philippines. She came here when she was 9, so she's like more Canadian than me. But anyways, tonight she was speaking about, you know, she has family back in the Philippines, my wife's mother-in-law. And she was saying that when couples are on their motorcycles in the Philippines, they have to put a plastic barrier between the driver and the person sitting behind. So then they go home and have dinner together and go to bed together. Exactly. This is the insanity. Sorry, Jenna, go ahead.
No, I agree. It's insane, some of these things, but that's a real insanity. I hadn't heard that one.
Oh yeah, they're holding a plastic barrier. So if whoever's sitting in the back, whether it be the boyfriend or the husband or whoever or the girlfriend, they're holding up a plastic barrier between their face and the person, and so they're like wavering on these motorbikes, these little mopeds, whipping around the Philippines. Like, this is happening. It's insane. Quebec, the province of Quebec, the only jurisdiction in North America to have a curfew at 10 o'clock every night, between 10 and I'm not sure what time in the morning, but probably around 4 or 5. But unbelievable. And I suppose in Quebec during the winter, there's not a whole lot to do after 10, unless you're going to a pub. And if the pubs aren't open, then I guess it's fine. But you understand what I'm saying is that we're allowing this illogical mass hallucination to grip us. Not all of us, of course, but and as I said, this quality that Robert and I have extensively talked about is almost like a possession. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a possession.
As I said to you, Jordan Peterson, who's a really, I would call him a very intelligent philosopher, came up with a term for this, and he calls it ideological possession.
Yes.
Where political ideology has stepped into people's brains, as you said, cut off the frontal cortex and conscience, and created a very, very radical and illogical and passionate ideologue. But it is like demonic possession. I'm queuing up something that I think if we have time I would like to play. It's Steve Jobs' last words. Now, I heard about Steve Jobs' last words, and they were, wow, oh wow, something to that effect. And I'm queuing this up, and this is a recitation of something that Steve Jobs supposedly said before he passed away, but I just queued it up so that we have a chance. We'll play it later. But I'd like to go back to Janet and Andrew, whom I interrupted. So.
Oh, you are.
We were talking about the ideological possession and communism.
Yeah. Well, we had a curfew in Maine this for a while after the COVID started, and you always wondered if you could go anywhere at night, because you'd go someplace and the police would be watching you. Go, oh God, am I doing something illegal? Am I not supposed to be out on the road? Felt very strange, I thought, when they had the curfew.
Yeah, and
well,
continues.
You know what? Go ahead, Andrew. Go ahead.
Well, it continues in Quebec. And Robert, I just want to add one more piece here, because this is really significant. I want to come back. I'm going to circle back to something that you said originally, Robert, at the beginning of the show, you know, talking about the American Constitution and specifically the Second Amendment. I think you mentioned something. Maybe you didn't, but there is such an attack on your country now. And I've said this from the start, you know, coming from a Canadian perspective, is that we have to have the United States still our truth beacon on this planet. And like any entity that's, you know, coming from a human base, we have our warts, all right? But in the United States, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but I'm just absolutely adamant about this, is that we can't lose your heart. You know, Robert talked about the heart, and it's really important that we hold it. Here's an example of a twisted and lowering and diminishing of a story that almost kind of happened. This comes from the New York Times from March 24th. It's really brief. You guys might know it. A heavily armed man was arrested at an Atlanta grocery store. A man who walked into an Atlanta grocery store on Wednesday wearing body armor and carrying six firearms was detained by the police and charged with reckless conduct, the police said. The incident came just days after a mass shooting at a grocery store in Boulder, Colorado that left 10 people dead, and about a week after shootings at spas in the Atlantic area that killed 8 people, and we get a hyphen here. Now listen to this. Listen to this nuance. 6 of them women of Asian descent. What about the other 2? On we go. The police said the man entered a Publix grocery store at Atlantic Station, a popular shopping and residential area northwest of downtown Atlanta. Officers went to the store where a manager told them that the man had entered with a rifle and had gone into a bathroom. The police detained the man, who had 2 long guns and 4 handguns with him, as well as body armor. Police initially reported that he had 5 guns in his possession. Now, let me finish up and let me just summarize it. The man, identified by the police as Rico Marley, age 22, was being held at the Fulton County Jail and was expected to have a first court appearance Thursday morning on charges of criminal attempt to commit a felony and possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony. Okay, we'll stop there. This man was African American. All right? Do you not think that if this guy was white, and especially in context with what the comment made about 6 of them are women of Asian descent, and my wife's Asian, okay? I have no qualms about anybody's color or heritage. I'm fine with everybody. But in this little nuanced, slanted story that didn't quite really make it, but, you know, it sort of kind of happened, and then it was quickly buried, is another example of this manipulation that, ooh, we haven't quite got the right shooter in place here. I may be getting into a conspiratorial place here, but you guys know what I mean. This is just misplacing the information yet again.
Well, they are trying to create racial division at every level. They're trying to turn black against white, Asians against blacks, on, you know, Native American against immigrant American. It's a wholesale attempt to create civil war, confusion, and division. On the other hand, as we all have to die, and many people have died before us, and one of the people who died before us was Steve Jobs. This is a man who was a creative genius, electronically speaking. His inventions, the iPhone that a lot of people are using, which is an enslavement device. I know it's, an iPhone is something that steals your consciousness and your awareness, and it blinds you. And this is what I mean by it blinds you. The human eye, human vision, has a scope approximately of 120 degrees. When you look out into the world and draw the radius, you're seeing 120 degrees. That includes your foveal vision and your peripheral vision. And what the iPhone has effectively done is put blinders on people and reduce the foveal vision. The foveal vision has been reduced from 10 degrees, because that's what it is. Foveal vision, central vision is 10 degrees. Peripheral vision encompasses 120 degrees. But the iPhone reduces your vision to just about, I would say, 2 to 5 degrees. It blinds you. You don't pay attention to the world around you. I've seen people playing Pokemon just totally drugged, intoxicated. Their eyes, when they looked up from the screen to answer my question, what are you hunting for? They looked like they were on narcotics. So Steve Jobs was, you know, the progenitor of this device. And he achieved world renown and incredible riches. And he died. But before he died, and those famous last words which were reported, that when he died, he said, "Wow, wow," something to that effect. But there's a recording that I sent out to, earlier today, and I've gotten quite a lot of feedback about it. Some people resented it. Some people tried to debunk it, because of all people on earth, Reuters claimed to have done a fact check. I wrote back to my friend, "I am not inclined to believe any fact check from Reuters, who has been lying to the world for over 200 years and has been a mouthpiece and an organ of disinformation for the British state for at least the last 150 years. But this, be that as it may, this recording was made of a man reading something that he claims came from Steve Jobs during the last weeks of his life. He had a lot of thoughts. And so I'd like to take 4 minutes and 30 seconds or so to share them, because they touched me. They touched me, and many other people are sending me thank you notes and messages on email for sharing this. So I'm trying to get the sound share cranking over here on Skype, which is sometimes a little slow to respond. And as soon as, okay, we're all set. So now I'm going to start sharing the sound. Of course, Janet and Andrew will be able to see it. Andrew already saw it. So I will do a quick sound check to see that Andrew's my sound technician as well. So it's all right away. If I might need to include one. Okay, so here we go.
Steve Jobs' last words will change your views.
Did you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Steve Jobs' last words will change your views. So let me cue it up one more time and take it from the beginning. It's only 4 minutes, but it's an amazing amount of information that is given.
Steve Jobs' last words will change your views on life. The billionaire passed away at the age of 56 of pancreatic cancer. These are his last words. I reached the pinnacle of success in the business world. In others' eyes, my life is an epitome of success. However, aside from work, I have little joy. In the end, wealth is only a fact of life that I am accustomed to. At this moment, lying on the sick bed and recalling my whole life, I realize the recognition and wealth that I took so much pride in have paled and become meaningless in the face of impending death. You can employ one to drive the car for you, make money for you, but you cannot have someone to bear the sickness for you. Material things lost can be found, but there is one thing that can never be found when it is lost. Life. When a person goes into the operating room, he will realize that there is one book that he has yet to finish reading. Look at agent now. With time, face the day when comes down.
Well, again, a little interference from the devil himself. So usually when I stop the tape, calms down.
Treasure love for your family, love for your spouse, love for your friends. Treat yourself well. Cherish others. As we grow older and hence wiser, we slowly realize that wearing a $300 or $30 watch, they both tell the same time. Whether we carry a $300 or $30 wallet or handbag, the amount of money inside is the same. Whether we drive a $150,000 car or a $30,000 car, the road and distance are the same, and we get to the same destination. Whether we drink a bottle of $300 or $10 wine, the hangover house we live in is 100 or 3,000 square feet. Loneliness is the same. Your true inner does not come from material things of this world. Whether you fly first or economy class, if the plane goes down, you go down with it. Therefore, I hope you realize when you have mates, buddies and old friends, brothers and sisters, who you chat with, laugh with, talk with, have sing songs with, talk about north, south, east, west or heaven and earth. That is true happiness. 5 undeniable facts of life. 1. Don't educate your children to be rich. Educate them to be happy. So, when they grow up, they will know the value of things, not the price. 2. Order birds in London to eat your medicines. Otherwise, you have to eat medicines as your food. 3. The ones who love you will never leave you for another because, even if there are 100 reasons to give up, he or she will find one reason to hold on. 4. There is a big difference between a human being and being human. Only a few really understand it. 5. You are loved when you are. You when you
quiet down. I'm banishing. That was a banishing ritual. Note, if you just want to walk fast, walk alone. But if you want to walk far, walk together.
Walk alone. But if you want to walk far, walk together. 6 best doctors in the world. 1. Sunlight. 2. Rest. 3. Exercise. 4. Diet. 5. Self-confidence. 6. Friends. maintain them in all stages of life, and enjoy a healthy life. God loves you.
Yes, God loves you. I would like to go back for a moment to the dream that I told you about, the draining of the swamp, and show you how real is the information that is communicated to us by the collective unconscious. David is a dear friend, but we've never met. He lives in San Francisco. I live in New York. And I told you that one of the strangest parts of the dream that I had was that I was driving a BMW station wagon. You know, I've never seen a white BMW station wagon. So the dream was very fascinating. So I called him and talked to him, and I told him the dream. And he said to me, when I said, you know, it's really weird. It was a white BMW, but not an ordinary one. It was a white station wagon. He said to me, oh, yeah, I had one of those. It cost me $125,000. I said, what? I had never known that. He had never talked to me about the cars or anything that he owned other than his computer. But there, the dream revealed to me something so unique that it puts the stamp of truth in the dream without my knowing that David even owned a car. He owned a white BMW station wagon racing model. That's what he said. That's why it cost $125,000. So I want you all to believe in your dreams, to pay attention. They are not noise. You know, a lot of psychiatrists and psychologists, you know, will try to tell you that dreams are meaningless and it's mental discharge or emotional anxiety or the kinds of things like that. And to finish up, I had another dream last night, which was similar. I was in the same place, you know. Remember I said the precipice went down and I was afraid to walk it? Well, now I was stuck having to rock climb up. And it was not easy. I had to rock climb up a vertical cliff, but it wasn't a cliff. It was a human construction that had an outcrop that came out, and then it bent back and then over onto the top. So what is that movie? Cliffhanger, I think it's called. A movie with Sylvester Stallone about these guys that like to hang off rocks. I personally do not like to rock climb. I do not like to be hanging from little shells of stone and gripping with four fingers and finding a notch. I don't like it. My brother got stuck on a cliff when I was about 12 years old, 200 feet above the High Bridge in New York City. Those of you who know, it's the highest point on Manhattan, Washington Heights. One side faces the Hudson and the other one faces the Harlem River. And my little brother, we climbed down, but when it came to climbing up, he got stuck. And I remember looking back and seeing his eyes and his face crying. He couldn't make that last grade. And my cousin Alfredo and I, we tied towels to our wrists. So I had one towel, he had it, and then he went and he pulled them up. And never since then have I ever wanted to climb any cliffs again. But in this dream, I had to struggle. If I let go, I'd die. I would fall 200 feet. But I struggled and I held on. And then the outcrop was the hardest part, you know, because there was hardly any grip. So I had to throw my hand blindly over the top and grip it and pull myself up and crawl up. But I made it, folks. I made it. And the dream is telling me, you're going to make it. We're all going to make it. As long as we have faith in ourselves and faith in each other, and we have to beat back this cabal of diabolical politicians and doctors, medicine, who have conspired to cow us all, to breed fear, in our heart of hearts and to make us conform. I think it's the most un-American thing to comply with all of these draconian mandates. And I remind people, now I don't wear a mask in New York. And the police, God bless them, in New York told the governor, we are not enforcing any mask mandate because it's unconstitutional. It deprives me of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In depriving me of oxygen, it's depriving me of life. In enforcing me, trying to force me to wear it, it's depriving me of liberty. And I'm not happy when I'm forced to wear a mask. So, right there. You know, and that is not unconstitutional. It's undeclarational, because that's not the Constitution. It's the Declaration of Independence. You know? So,
I've heard that, you know, this whole 6 feet thing, when humans are within 6 feet of each other, that's when the heart chakra connects with the other person's heart chakra. But if you're 6 feet apart, that doesn't happen. Have you heard that?
Yes, I've heard that. But I've also heard that they reduced the distance to 3.5 feet now in some places. So
no, not here yet.
It's all fake. It's all arbitrary. It's all diktats of the dictators. And the worst of them is Anthony Fauci. Folks, I'm going to tell you plainly. Dr. Anthony Fauci is the father of COVID-19. He is the designer. He was the man who was working on gain-of-function experiments to make coronavirus more lethal.
Oh.
In 2015, he was forbidden by the FDA, which criminalized gain-of-function research on viruses that are not lethal and not virulent, that weren't easy to transmit between people. But he was doing that work, and they told him, you're quite crazy. You can't do it anymore. So what he did is he bundled up his research, and he sent his principal assistant, a Chinese virologist named Dr. Xi, sent him to Wuhan, and he gave Chinese Communist Party $7.4 million to conduct his research. He's a criminal. He belongs in Nuremberg. He belongs under the treaty, not for the city. So this is the whole agenda.
Thank you.
Listening to Revolution Radio.
What the heck is the truth, jihad? Hey, I'm Kevin Barrett, host of Truth Jihad Radio. Federal prosecutors, Department of Homeland Security agents, and curious passersby often ask me, just what is this truth jihad thing anyway? Well, everybody knows what truth is, but jihad is a misunderstood term. Jihad means effort or struggle. The greater jihad is the struggle to be a better person, while the lesser jihad is the struggle to defend the community. Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, did say that the best jihad is a word of truth flung in the face of a tyrant. And that's what we do here at Truth Jihad Radio. Every Friday, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Pacific, right here on Revolution Radio.
Be evasive. But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth, as opposed to fiction.
And Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, and there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Hello, my name is Mr. Rowe.
I am the host of Reality Extraction, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion. You can find me on Studio B every Thursday at 7.